Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. So we don't really need to explain who Mark Knopfler is, do we?
I don't think so.
You don't need my Bill Frindle figures on the fact that this was the most massive album of all time, Brothers in Arms.
But I was going to say, well, it's certainly a great opportunity for you to roll out the Bill.
Yeah, but I mean,
the stats are...
Come on. I haven't got them on me anyway, because we are doing this face to face. I have not brought my notes. I'm just sitting here.
And you're actually off your wing. Because I usually don't have notes. That's right. You usually have notes. I don't have notes because I never refer to them. And I rely on you for the facts. I'm just tabloid speculation.
But it's suffice to say that Dire Straits were unbelievably huge in the 80s.
Unbelievably huge. But it was those huge albums. The first album was really big, then second, then third. But then it was the kind of defining CD, wasn't it? That was the thing. Brothers in Arms ushered in the digital era.
Yeah, because I remember having a CD player and then Brothers in Arms came out and it was recorded digitally and everyone was freaking out about this. And also we knew already from Love Over Gold that, you know, what Dire Straits made was sort of cinema for the ears.
That's yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Telegraph Road or Private Investigation.
I was listening to, you know, because listening to Telegraph Road earlier and I realized, and it's that, it's again, it's got that sort of Springsteen-y, although it's not, because Springsteen-y doesn't tell sort of long historical stories, which is what that is, isn't it? It's like the evolution of a town. But the thing that makes you think Springsteen is because it's actually got Roy Bataan on it.
It's the same
playing
people.
The piano. Yeah.
But it's also, you know, that great sort of quality of atmosphere that he creates. And you kind of knew that Mark was going to eventually go into making music for film. And of course, now we're here discussing his solo career, which is even longer than his Dire Straits career.
And with so many great stuff like working with Emmy Lou Harris and stuff. But what I can't wait to talk about is quite possibly the most epic guitar lineup ever assembled on a record.
Yes, this new version of his old instrumental.
Going Home.
Going Home. Who's on it? Who's not on it?
Exactly. Let's ask him. That should actually kill most of the hour.
Yes. Well, that's us. And I'm thrilled to meet him. I feel kind of in awe because his guitar, he's a triple threat, isn't he? And we can ask him, talk to him about this. A triple threat, he's a great songwriter. He's an incredible singer. And wow, what a guitar player.
He's actually a quadruple threat because he's also a Geordie.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London, they're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a bite. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
So, thanks for coming on, Mark.
It's a great pleasure. I mean, people have been boasting about you for some reason, and, you know, so I thought I'd check it out.
Well, we've had John on as a... Yeah. Told you, he was, we've had a lot of the dirt was dished on Dire Straits.
A lot of dirt, exactly, yeah.
So, Glad we can get that out of the way. Big clean-up job to do today.
Big clean-up job, obviously.
I thought that was done?
No. Just want to say congratulations on the new record, though, because it sounds fantastic. We got a sneak preview of the album.
Do you get sneak previews?
We did, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing it myself.
Yeah, but we can't tell you who does that. The only thing I couldn't find a list of the musicians because you still work because you got quite a nice regular core of
you had a lovely
I
remember
Danny Cummings is he
lovely boys the... yeah Danny on percussion
yeah.
Yeah
I've known for many
and
years,
Yanto lovely. Thomas on drums
Yanto yeah
oh Yanto I've just yeah. done some things with Yanto
yeah
so he really great
he works a lot you know if the National Opera comes to town Yanto gets the gig because he can read so well. And he said, well, you've got to learn to read. You might as well do it do it well. That's because he has that proper upbringing in music, mm-hmm. the music mm-hmm. thing. Do you have one? Or do you have
no.
one?
No, I don't. No, I'm pop, old bedroom, box bedroom, punk really? Rocker. Yeah, yeah, that one.
Wow.
But
you've
got
can
to I be... say, mm. as a musician, sorry, I just want to say on behalf of myself and certainly pretty much every musician I know, I just want to say an honest, very sincere thank you for British Grove Studios.
Well,
because it's everyone I know.
Because you just went there with David, didn't you?
I spent a week Gilmore. In there, yeah, with yeah. Steve Gadd playing drums.
Mm. I've never had a bad day in there. And it's not because I'm any good, it's because the studio's so good. I had some very good help, you know, I had some great people on hand to sort of watch over it as it was coming together. And one of whom we lost to COVID at
yeah.
the beginning.
Of course, yeah,
David
yeah.
David Stewart.
Dave Stewart, yeah.
But then it was, there's been Dave Harries, who you probably know from old days in Air Studios.
Right, right.
Who was the first technician to refuse to wear a white coat to operate the machinery.
Amazing, wow. Air.
And he's actually a bit of a heavy metal head. You know, he says, give it more, give it, you want to, you know, give it more heavy fuel. And so he's a bit like that. And also we have Graham Meek, who's the previous head tech of mm-hmm. Decca, you know, and so it's a good solid.
But to even begin a studio nowadays it's quite a risky business, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. all the studios were closing.
I was ready to lose money, and I did. I mean, the thing is, you've got to be ready to subsidize something if you want to do it properly like that. And there's a huge amount of support for it. You'll get somebody will call up and go, "Hey, welcome. I've just been down the shed. I just found a load of valves, and we've got a cupboard in the studio full of valves for old microphones, old things that are really, really rare. And there's things in boxes in drawers all over the country of people who are into all
people
this
go
stuff.
For the old yeah. microphones that you must
because yeah because I want to point out because the thing I didn't realize because for years I thought there's these two desks on either side of the control room, which I thought was sort of ornamental. I didn't know whether, so you've basically got the main desk, mixing desk in the room. Then you've got a Sergeant Pepper era EMI desk.
60s and then, one, yeah.
And then the Dark Side of the Moon era desk. Was it?
The first
and they're all plumbed in. Oh, so we were running all the drums through them. Yeah, yeah. It's insane.
Yeah, so because the outputs of these old desks have got to be altered a little bit so that they can work with the new stuff.
Right, right.
So,
and do you curate all that, Mark? Are you still looking for gear and thinking that's going
to
be perfect?
I don't have to. I mean, they'll occasionally waft things in front of me. Say,
get your checkbook out.
Yeah. So, but no, actually, we don't have any more room, seriously, for anything like that. The one thing we do need is more storage space.
So on this album, do you write at home?
I never write in the studio because it's a recording studio. I have a sort of reverence for recording studios. And I feel as though I've always felt that they should really be used for recording. If you start writing... It doesn't feel right to me if you start. Do you agree?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But
also,
I love that.
Clock's yeah. ticking as well.
That's what that sounds like. Well, not for him. Yeah, that's, but that, I mean, that sounds like a great admonishment. It's a recording studio. How else do you think you're doing?
Well, just because there are. I mean, I write in privacy.
Yeah.
I don't like other people sitting waiting, or getting the coffee. No. And so when you're at home doing that, did you have all of this album prepared before you went in, or were you doing it in as the songs
were
coming?
You've got to keep looking at what you've got. I mean, and keep. And I remember when I was working when I started working with Bob Dylan, that Bob would get up occasionally and just go to his song, and get away from that. Just his song would be on the floor in his bag or something. He'd go to it, and I was doing the same thing. So I'll have the band in there, but I'll be checking a lyric, just a line, whether because as soon as you both know very well, when you start performing something, it may very well just change a little bit of fret, just because it comes off differently.
The scansion or
somehow it just the song thing does that to it.
Yeah,
you know, when it becomes a song, it starts to be something else.
You talk about Dylan. I'm very interested because when you were, when you produced him, like, which must have been, what was that like when being
Don't tell me when things. I mean, don't ask.
No,
sorry.
I'm asking you when.
Sometime
I'm
in 19,
terrible. I'm terrible on dates, you know. Talk to Kitty. She's brilliant on dates.
83, I think, was the first one, or 84. Slow Train of Coming. But when you're talking about the writing thing, the fact that Dylan at that point, because he's had this massive Christian revelation, and so he clearly had a very real strong agenda for what he wanted to say on his album. Yeah. And I'm wondering if that was maybe a sort of different to what how he would usually approach an album.
Yes, it was different because he said to Jerry Wexler, he said, I've been making like home records. I want to do like a professional record.
So that's why he got you in?
No, I think I think Jerry got me and pick in because we would just happen to be playing around him at that point.
Because he'd just come to you in L.A., hadn't he? He came to see Dire Straits.
Yeah, we'd been down in Alabama. I'd been down to Alabama, or I'd been down there just to watch Jerry and get to know Barry Beckett, who was a wonderful guy. And I got to be pally with Barry, and I learned a lot from Barry. And in fact, I learned the little bit that I did learn, I learned from great engineers, really, and which is why I never learned to be an engineer. Pretty soon reckoned that it was beyond me. But I was lucky enough to work with some great engineers from the beginning. Rhett Davies, first album.
Oh, yeah.
Did lots of music, didn't he?
Yeah, but it was Rhett who stole me from this Australian band Ice House to play for Brian Ferry. Yeah, he was one of the most important people in my life.
Exactly, yeah. And he was engineering the first album with Muff Winwood.
Right.
And Muff, well, if we can't get a record out of that, we're all custards. He used to say things like that. Steve's brother, lovely man. Another lovely man, Steve.
Love the tune. That was the fact that used to be a famous thing when Muff was sort of doing A&R, CBS he liked everything. There used to be a thing of people saying, oh, we've got this meeting at CBS, you know, we're really excited about it. And sort of friends of yours would go off and they go, you know, how'd it go? Muff really liked the tune. Uh-huh. And he's now to say, Muff likes everything.
Well, Muff was our A&R.
Doesn't mean you're getting a deal.
Yeah. He played in Creed, he played with Creedence.
Spencer
Davis. Spencer
Davis. Yeah, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, Creedence Aston Revival.
We'll get. I just want to do a bit
more. It's funny, I spend a lot of time talking with a mate about music, and he plays in a band in pubs at nights, and they have all the work they can handle. They're just playing the hits. So we talk a lot about Creedence songs.
That was just the coincidence.
Those songs were so great.
Oh, yeah.
And so we'll end up, the conversation will come round to Creedence songs and to how, the singer, that voice.
Who's the singer?
Tom Fogerty.
The new album's called One Deep River, right? So it's the Tyne, isn't it? Again.
Yes.
And this connection that you have with...
Spoiler!
With Newcastle. It's... and this is the thing what I've always admired about what you do, and right from the very beginning on the first album for Dire Straits, is taking American music, that Americana, but instead of singing about America, singing about stuff that we know, singing about the West End of London or Newcastle. Mm-hmm. Was that how did you pull that together?
Yeah, it was deliberate. I mean, what I really wanted to try to do was, I don't know whether it came off, but was to try to make it the geography. Because if you were in America, you had the geography, you had Route 66, didn't you?
Mm.
You had it all. And that's going back a long way into the music, and the history of the music. And you had Pennsylvania 65,000.
Because it was the pride they had in their country.
Yeah.
There was no cynicism.
Just the whole thing spoke music. And so I was trying to just do the same with my own little geography. So if I was going south, I'd write a song like Southbound Again, or try and bring my own, going down to London, try and bring my own movement.
But you're right, because actually what Springsteen did is, because you said, because this whole thing of the drama of American places, but the funny thing is because if you're not singing about the wide open spaces, the stuff that Springsteen used to write about when he said, we'll meet neath that giant Exxon sign that brings this fair city light. He's talking about the equivalent of an Esso garage in Basel.
Yeah. Which we can't
see. You know what I mean? It's not, you know.
But I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, we'd reached a time in our evolution as a country where we were a bit cynical about the place. And it didn't have the same aspirational quality that Americana did. Mm-hmm. But I think what you also embraced was folk music.
Yeah.
There's always been elements of that, which is about the ordinary people in that country. And
yeah. And I had this duality thing going on all the time because for so long, I'd want an electric guitar like that. That of everything, actually, very similar to that. That's what I wanted. I wanted the solid version. I wanted the Stratocaster lookalike. I had to wait. I had to wait and wait. And so I'd borrow acoustic guitars from friends and very bad ones. And but I did start going into folk joints and was exposed to a lot of folk music. And so the beauty of that was that I had to really learn how to finger pick. I learned a rudimentary... I had a sort of singing nun finger pick, which didn't get me very far.
Not Travis. Then that famous nun Travis.
And then a folk singer up in Newcastle taught me how to do the clawhammer thing, which the picking, which is four beats to the bar with the thumb. And that really made a difference. And so... wanting to be a rocker, wanting to play the blues, wanting to play in a blues band, desperately wanting all of that stuff, you know. But at the same time, being exposed to an awful lot of acoustic music as well. So,
because there was actually a folk revival in the early 70s, wasn't there?
And actually my thing with the blues was I got even more fortunate because I got in Leeds, when I moved to Leeds to work, I got to know a guy called Steve Phillips, who was a blues singer, and he had National Steel guitars, and he had a proper record collection, records specially delivered from the States. And so I got to hear a lot of early blues singers and got exposed to a lot of other music too that became like ragtime music, jug band music, all sorts and rare hillbilly music as well, you know, white music as well as black music, and the whole thing just broadened.
But didn't you start on sort of boogie woogie piano through your Uncle Kingsley,
bless him. Did you read about Uncle Kingsley?
I read a bit about Uncle Kingsley.
He met him recently.
Kingsley was just, it was so much fun.
I just think everyone should have an uncle called Kingsley.
Was brilliant. And he,
this is in Newcastle, I guess.
Yeah, and no, actually, yes, in Newcastle. Well, we were in Glasgow at the time and we'd visit every now and again where my nana lived, where mum's mum lived. And Kingsley was one of her sons. And so we... but he blew a harmonica. He'd do the Runaway Train on a harmonica, and he had a banjo, which he couldn't play, but I just still thought, how cool to have a banjo. And
is he kind of a skiffle head?
Yeah, he would have been. And he played a bit of boogie woogie, and when I heard boogie woogie on a piano for the first time, I just remember these great blocks of logic just sailing into place, you know, just bang. This is for me. And I was four, I think, however old I was. I just remember thinking, that's where I'm going. You know, I'm headed in that direction.
But how come you ended up on the guitar?
I always wanted a guitar from the very, very beginning. I think I must have been pointed to a white plastic one in a toy shop window and said, I want that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't allowed to have it. And, you know, it's a good thing. I think a bit of wanting doesn't hurt too much. And of course, I became slightly obsessed, I think, with the guitar. And what's wrong with being slightly obsessed? As long as it didn't make me into a raving loony, I, you know, just kept wanting a guitar.
Because I think, there's a shop in one of the arcades in Newcastle? Yeah.
Windows.
Guitar shop, yeah.
Easy name to remember, Windows. Yeah. We had nose pressed up against it a lot of the time.
No, because there's a thing, because I know what you mean, because I'm sure you had this, Gary. There's that thing when I spent all of my school holidays just on Charing Cross Road, Denmark Street, just looking at guitars. And once you've got one, there's something different about those shops aren't quite the same because they just had this unattainable thing, you know, and that smell.
Well, I think you always want the next one up, though, don't you? Yeah. You know, you start with the one your parents give you for Christmas. I know you got a guitar, but you got quite a good guitar, didn't you? From your
well, it was 50 quid.
50 quid, mate.
The solid body version of that, same price.
The Hofner.
Yeah, they were about 50 quid. When I was 15.
Had you chosen that, or did
they wanted me to have a nice, you know, in the shop, and my dad said, why don't you get a nice wooden F-holes, you know, and to me, it had to be like Hank's from The Shadows, you know, so I couldn't have a Strat, I couldn't have a Fender, because they were too expensive for my old man, so it was 50 quid or...
But you
that was his limit, really. So
yeah,
we got
in those days, mate. That's
yeah,
fair.
Was, yeah. What did he do for a living? I want to know. What did he do?
he was a CEO. Yeah.
No, he worked in the city architects department, and he never changed. He just wanted to work for the public, so he never went private.
Oh, that's right. A good staunch socialist.
So yeah. So that's what he used to call them architects. You know, those. So he just wanted to work for the public.
You ended up doing as well, really. If you like, we work for the public, don't we?
I guess
as musicians. But if you brought that electric guitar home, solid body, you're not getting much of a sound out of it. But I didn't really realize
that. I mean, I hadn't thought about an amplifier. I was so overcome with wanting the guitar, you know. And I got somebody to change a jack plug that came with a guitar and to plug it into the back of the radio, the old radio that we had in the house. And I just blew up the radio in about 3 days. I don't think it lasted very long.
I had the same thing with my first bass, because it was the same, because my parents said, why don't you get a nice acoustic? Because I didn't want a bass. I wanted an electric guitar.
Yeah.
And they said, why don't you get a nice acoustic guitar? And it's like, well, a toaster would be nearer what I'm after than an acoustic guitar. It's the electric bit. So I asked for a bass, but I did the same thing where I didn't have an amp, and I managed to get mine wired up to the back of the stereo.
Yeah.
Same thing. But the only thing was I could play the bass and I could play records, but not at the same time.
No. So you can play.
So I have to listen, just like sit there, listening and play along to the memory.
Yeah, no, I know how you must have felt, because I didn't really have a record collection ever, and not exactly. I mean, I have times when I'd listen to other people's records, like anything. But I never, this is another good thing, though, I think, in a way, is that it's how you copy. Some people just copy absolutely every inflection and every note. And I never had a record to do that with.
Right,
you know,
right.
Some people would do, and jazzers used to do it, I think. You know,
Slow down the record.
Yeah, and I think they would, when they'd be dropping the needles on things, I think even people like Charlie Parker would be doing things like that, just disappear with some records and then just play them and play them and play them and play them. But I never quite did that. I fell in love with, say, so many people, or I fell in love with B.B. King. And and so I tried to play like that, but I couldn't. I don't think I ever really sat down when kept dropping the needle on something again and again and again, because I didn't really think I had a needle to drop, particularly, or a record collection per se. There would be temporary... I might be in with a record for a while, but it would probably never really be.
So your style became an amalgam of all these people.
Yeah, sort of.
Although
an amalgam.
I have to say, Mark, I can still hear Hank in some of the stuff you do.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that choice of sound and melody that, you know.
Yeah,
also,
well,
the fact that you played with. Sorry, but you had that fabulously clean sound at a time when people who were playing guitar in that arena didn't at all.
Well, I was playing. When I started playing with a Strat, I was already starting to play with my fingers. Mm-hmm. But I'd have a pick in my pocket so I could always do both things, you know. So I started playing with a plectrum. And a plec is the best thing in guitar. I mean, it's louder, it's cleaner. You both know that, you know, that gives the best signal for recording. It's fantastic. The finger thing was just a bit of a mess that just came together slowly, and I kept losing picks. And I was starting, the finger style was starting to jump across the strings, so rather than the thumb just being on the lower string. So it was starting to wander up where it didn't belong. And so I was starting to develop a style which any guitar teacher would tell you is just wrong. And
partly because I guess you're left-handed, but you were playing it right-handed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Sorry, my brethren.
Are you?
That's what he does.
Yeah. With this, yes.
So I think one of the advantages.
I've been saying that my whole life. I've forgot that. I'm always going, yeah, no, Martin Opfer's the same, you know.
Yeah, well, then.
He makes love.
I was going to ask you what your secret was.
Was that? Yeah,
so that was your secret, then.
I think. Because you have a strong. I do have a. I mean, I'm sorry, I've just realised that we are a minority here, Gary, and we could be persecuted. So.
Be gentle with him, Gary. Be gentle. Yeah,
but did you not. I mean, was it just the way you picked it up?
Yeah, well, I think when I picked up a tennis racket to play guitar on it.
Yeah.
I picked it up left-handed, yeah.
Oh, that's
but your so parents gave you a right-handed guitar.
Ruth did. My sister said, I remember turning the tennis racket around and said, "That you played that way." And then I had some violin lessons at school, which never got anywhere because I wanted to play guitar. Once I was playing a bit of violin, the guitar had to be that way.
Because all violins are played right-handed. There's no such thing. Otherwise, they'd be sticking bows in each other's.
What that would be like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, to me, it always just seems to make more sense because that's actually the hand that's doing the sort of more complicated stuff, although you were finger-picking. But the one thing I do remember being aware of, even as a complete novice, was that when I started playing, that I got pretty nifty quickly, more compared to the people around me, but I sounded terrible.
Your rhythm?
No, just the actual sound.
Oh, right.
So I was thinking, my finger. That took me a long time.
A long time. Yeah, and I've got such.
I mean, that last week.
You know, well, I have such admiration for bass players because I've tried to play bass occasionally, and it's exactly as you say. It's there's such a lot in that right hand, isn't there?
Yeah.
What do you mean? How hard can it be?
You ended up going down. Well, enough of him, anyway. You went down to London. Then is that was really just because you didn't feel that Leeds was going to be the place for you to find a band.
I wanted to go to university because I'd missed that bit out, and I felt as though I didn't know anything. So I left the newspaper. I was working as a junior on a newspaper.
There's a beautiful song about that on your last album, isn't it? Really, really lovely song about being in the office.
So anyway, thank you. But I tell you what, it sorted me out as a kid. I think I had to wake up, you know, I had to get myself organized. I think with a job on a newspaper makes you do that and makes you understand the way the world works a little bit.
Well, also, what I was saying, that because of the way you write, I wonder about, because I'm wondering which way around it came, because you clearly have a great nose for a story. All your songs have great stories. But I'm wondering if that came from being a journalist or it was the other way around.
Well,
you became a journalist because you naturally have a nose for a story.
No, it actually made me into a songwriter, I think, because I didn't see myself as a songwriter at all. I just thought a strummer. I was just a strummer. And I remember some of the stories that I was doing for the paper, I'd see them in my notebook, bits of them in my notebook afterwards, and they'd started creeping into the songs. So if I was sent to interview the cast of the City Varieties in Leeds, and go and talk to the cast of the pantomime, and I'd be talking to the ugly sisters, you know, a couple of old dudes, you know, we're proud to be the oldest ugly sisters in variety, you know, and things.
I thought we had that.
And that became, careful, because I might just, that became,
we might
One More Matinee, a song, One More.
Right, right.
So I started taking their lines and making them into lines in a song. And I think that's when I did transferred. I might have had bits of songs, but I certainly didn't. I was busy copying songs. I don't think I was could see myself as a songwriter at all. And so I sort of eased into that way and ended up being the guy who writes the songs. And now I think I'm a songwriter and a musician. I'm very different from being a songwriter. To me is very different from being musician.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
because you spend a lot more time on words, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
that.
The most important part.
And neglecting the guitar.
Because it's very rare to have, because you are, to have someone who's such a basically virtuoso as a musician to be a songwriter as well. It's usually
But before you came in, I described you as a triple threat. You can see you can play guitar and you write great songs.
Well,
very often the guy who writes the songs is the guy who knows the least chords in the band.
Well, and now that is true. Yeah. And I just through this pandemic, for instance, the amount of playing I've done is nothing, and I've had COVID 3 times, and I think I just stopped playing for a lot of that, and I'd stopped playing for a lot of time before, and I'd just be busy writing songs and
storytelling,
and touring, and when you're touring, just writing songs, and neglecting the playing. So because the songs tend to be nursery rhymes, and so you're not really concentrating the way if I think about a musician. If I think about, say, the guy who plays, say, bass in my band, that would be Glenn Wolfe.
Glenn Wolfe, yeah.
There's a man with a relationship with his instrument that is enviable, and also he can play. Which got me tied up with him in the first place. He can play stand up.
He's essentially a country player, isn't he? That's where he comes from.
I suppose.
Are you saying that what drives your songs?
Zen thing in the world.
What drives your songs mostly is the storytelling. Do you think that's what inspires the music?
Yes, I think so. And but it's not the music. What I mean is that if you take someone like Yanto or someone like Jim Cox on the piano, the relationship with the instrument is absolute. It's total. And I can't get that going with a guitar now. I'll be spending time looking at the songs.
But it'll be the sound. You'll be inspired by the sound of a particular instrument.
Oh yeah,
or a song. So
that's Hank,
different. But anyway, yeah. So that's a relationship with the instrument generally, which is kind of which you have to have as opposed to one particular instrument.
Yeah, you fall in love with the sounds, just like I fell in love with Hank.
Yeah,
with the sound of the guitar as a kid, mm-hmm. and I'd be getting into trouble for what's that sound?
Very much that first album with Sultans of Swing was very much about the Fender Strat. That seemed
A little point to make is that Ed Bicknell, who was your manager and then bandmate, not who is that when he came to see the Dire Straits the first time, it was the fact that you had a red Strat.
Yeah, red Strat and sounding.
Otherwise might well not have managed
and
you.
Probably clean sounding as well at that point.
You've all got Buddy Holly and Hank to thank.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm playing a song like Why Worry, we used to call it Why Bother. I think of Buddy Holly,
Yeah.
And those three chords and just do 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 do, and there was one point where, but this is what happens. This is what happened. The gift that songs brought me with what I call circular moments where you've written the song. I used to worship the Everly Brothers and the Everly Brothers were singing it. They'd recorded it, and they were singing it, and I was playing in the band. Oh. I'd not on their recording, but I was playing in the band. We were doing a show with Chet Atkins in Nashville at Vanderbilt, and a TV show. And the Everlys were singing there, and I'm standing there going, "There, that's the Evs, and they're singing my song."
Oh, wow. What song did they do?
What they were singing, Why Worry.
Oh, right.
And those moments, I've had a few. I had one with the Shads where they'd recorded The Local Hero.
Because Hank played it on stage home. With you.
Yeah. And Hank used to get up with us at the end of a set and do that quite often. But
Geordie Boy.
They were, yeah. But when I remember standing, it was the Dominion Theatre. I remember standing on stage with the Shadows, thinking, that's
did,
the
did
Shads.
Did you do the steps?
I never mastered the steps. I may have tried.
The third one's quite tricky.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We were talking about your songwriting, you know, being an observer and a journalist in your style, because that's where Sultans came from, didn't it? That was you in a mind telling the story.
Not at all.
The thing is, you tell stories in your songs all the time, but now the greatest stories are your own.
Yeah, right? well, there can be situation songs where the circumstances are just right, because there's a little guy in a sweater, and he looks like your geography teacher, you know, and he's surrounded by other guys like that, you know, who are all in the band, and this decidedly grubby little South London pub. And
can you remember the pub?
I used to know the name of the pub, and I could take you there if it's still there in Greenwich.
It deserves a plaque, really.
And he said at the end of the night, he said, "Well, on the last song now." He said, "We are the Sultans of Swing," and they are so not the Sultans of Swing, you know. It's such a glamorous name, isn't it? It's, you know, brilliant. The Sultans of Swing. They were so not.
But was that just a description he was giving them, or that was actually the band name?
That was his band name.
So, yeah. But so
they were the Sultans of Swing.
So did he? He's listening to the radio, and you go, "The Sultans of Swing," and there's someone going, "Wait a minute."
He said the line, "We are the Sultans of Swing." Yeah. He said.
But this is the beautiful thing, that you end up writing that song in a band that maybe is a little out of its time, you know, punk's happening and you're playing in this sort of slightly old school style. Mm. And there's a sort of irony about you guys singing songs and swinging. You haven't even got a record contract. Of course, it becomes one of the biggest songs ever. So the journey that the song took was very personal to you.
Yeah. And then later on, that same sort of thing would happen a little bit later on. I was in an electrical shop in New York, and there was a wall of TVs, and they were all tuned to MTV. And there was a delivery bloke in there sounding off about the artists that were on the MTV thing, you know. And it was hilarious. I was laughing at him. And no, I didn't want him to see me laughing. So I had to sort of retreat. And I was spying on him really through a gap in the microwaves, you know. And I was still laughing when I actually went and asked for a piece of paper and a pen, you know, a reception thing. And I sat down in the kitchen display area in the front of the store and started writing the song. And that song, I mean, he'd given me the lines, "That ain't working," and "Maybe get a blister on your little finger," you know, and stuff. So it was, he'd given me so it was like the Sultans of Swing, and it was a situation song. Yeah. It was there. And sometimes you just get the little bells going off that they combine. You know, for instance, I remember I was on a plane looking down at Philadelphia, and it was just big motorways and big chemical works and refineries, and that was Philadelphia. And I was reading a book at the time on the plane. I was reading a book called Mason and Dixon about the Mason-Dixon line. Mason and Dixon, two guys that come out from England on a bar. Used to come out by ship. It used to take a few weeks to sail over, and it wasn't that long ago, really, that there was nothing there, and now, you know, America's just grown so fast, and it was a place, and looking down on it from that, you know, from that height, from the plane, and then being in the book where they're on this barge that sailed from the west coast of England somewhere to a ship that's just sailed, and they've gone to do the Mason-Dixon line, and to sort out a dispute between a couple of states. And I just, the song comes together because there are certain conditions, you know, and it strikes you, you know, because they were frightened of the interior. Nobody had actually been to the interior of America when they went there.
Oh, right.
They didn't know what they were going to find. I mean, it was just savages and possibly and the unknown.
But this is also ringing romantic bells with you, because this is what a rock band is doing. You know, you're coming over from yeah. England, and you're suddenly in every state in the across America.
You're so right. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you're dead right. Yeah, because that was always the question, wasn't it? Did they break America?
Yeah,
wasn't it? Did you? How did you get on in the States?
Yeah, yeah.
Did they break America?
But with Telegraph Road, you did the same thing. Were you sitting up the front of the bus?
Yeah, and Telegraph Road was there, and I saw the sign, Telegraph Road, and I could see 12 lanes of traffic. And I thought, what was this once?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's what they call linear development, I think, remembering from my geography there. Mm. But
buildings down the main highway,
just
post
down,
road.
Down the road, exactly that. And then that becomes modern America with the Texaco station and the Coca-Cola sign, and that development has been so quick, so fast, and that's how I've actually seen it happen, because I actually went to Nashville to record there, because I didn't have a studio, and it was, I think it was 83, and it's a different place now.
That's because everyone moved to Nashville. That was the funny thing, wasn't it? It was the country place, and now it's just like
I wasn't going there to make country music, though. I was going, I was just writing my songs.
No, but I mean, I know people in, you know, heavy metal bands all live in Nashville now. Like, everyone lives in Nashville. It's kind of, that's become it.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it?
But there's also a good song you wrote about Eleuthia, and this is what I love about your writing. And what I find it, this is inspirational, thinking more about this recently as a songwriter myself, is you took some of his goodbyes on his emails, because he was building a guitar for you.
Yeah. John Monteleone, and who comes from a long line of genius guitar builders, and again, he was making me that nice acoustic guitar that your parents always wanted you to have, or that your parents wanted you to have, and that goes back to a tradition in New York of building those guitars, but. And that goes back even further to a tradition of building violins in Cremona in Italy. And that goes back to the Stradivarius and the Guarneri and the Amati. Amati, is it? You know, the great violinists. And they always had, the great violin makers always had apprentices. And I was thinking about John Monteleone, because he was, you know, because they used to be apprentices to great guitar builders in New York, and John was the last of a line and didn't have an apprentice, because you can't find kids these days to have got the patience for it or whatever it is. And so I was thinking about that, but John used to sign off emails to me with little lines, say, well, I've got to get back, the chisels are calling, you know, and it's time to make sawdust. And
oh, that's a lovely line.
And that's what I thought. So I ended up writing the song about once he sent me a piece of wood, because he would always be listening to the wood, you know, like that, rapping on the wood like that. And one day, one of his mandolins, I thought it was the same shape as his mandolin, beautiful piece of maple. And the wood was about half an inch thick and cut out in the shape of one of his mandolins. And I opened it up, and he said, I've sent you this as a cheese board. He said, you know, because obviously it wasn't sounding right for him.
Right.
So he made it into a cheese board. So I've got a Monteleone cheese board at home.
And when you first started with your demos were just so famous, because I remember, do you not remember the story of them saying, oh yeah, they could never reproduce Sultans of Swing, and the demo had to be the one in the end.
But that used to be the massive thing, which of course doesn't exist now, does it? Because whatever you start working on, it just becomes. It used to be you can't get it to sound like the demo.
Demo-itis.
That's right. Well, you must have spent a lot of time doing that though in your career.
In my van, we did our first demos at Pathway in Islington, because we were all Islington boys, and that's. Yeah. I remember going in there and everyone saying, "This is where Sultans was recorded."
Yeah, Pathway was amazing, wasn't it? Yeah, you know, there was the control room had a bench. I mean, the control room, it wasn't any bigger than that rug, was it?
Probably not. No, you're right.
You know, you'd sit down one end of
That's right.
And that was a window and a little studio, but it was an 8-track studio. And I remember Chas Herrington, who was engineer there, who ended up doing lights for us. I remember him talking about, because the reggae bands used to go in there as well. And, you know, sometimes there'd be a lot of serious dope smoking going on in there. And Chas was laughing about something that had happened the night before. He said, I was sitting here, he said, it was the early hours of the morning, suddenly this boom comes through the speakers. He nearly blew the speakers out. He said, what was that? And he said, quick edit, man, tied a nut in the tape.
Could you reproduce what you wanted when you went back in, when you went in with Muff? What do we all hear? We all hear
just a little. I mean, it was this cut down. It was just a really stripped down band, wasn't it? Just because Pick wasn't a heavy metal drummer by any stretch of the imagination. Pick was a school drummer. He was great, but he'd done a lot
Boys
of.
Boys Brigade.
He was doing a yes. He was that, he was yeah. doing a lot of folk music actually. He'd come up doing quite a lot of folk rock, but he was really. Really precise, and I remember Muff telling him, "Pick, you know, just don't stop doing all that stuff on the top." He said, "Just make it more basic." You know, he was always telling him to simplify it a little bit.
Story of my life.
Story of your life.
Bass players.
Go on, guy.
No, because I was just really interested in those early days, like who your peers were on that circuit. Because when you were talking about writing, I just thought it was a shame that we never got to mention Brewer's Droop.
Yeah.
Which is without a doubt the most definitively named pub rock band ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is literally ground zero for pub rock. Yeah,
they gave the groupies the warning beforehand, did they?
Yeah. So, what happened there was that it was the Melody Maker came out every week and he used to have the ads in the back.
Yeah. No breadheads or time wasters.
No beards.
You've been that man, right? And if you had an ad that you could afford an ad in the back that wasn't just a small ad, it was a bigger ad, it meant that it was a recording band, you know. And it actually It said, band, RCA band or record contract or whatever it was, you know. And so I just left college that minute and went straight to the audition.
And you weren't writing then, though? You were,
No, not really. I went straight to the audition. And when I got off the train in High Wycombe and I was walking along to the pub where they were having these auditions, I could see a trail of guitarists coming back the other way into the station, you know, because they were all having, you had to get the train out there. And that's what that was. And actually, when I left, there was still a trail of guitar players, you know. Because back then, as now, there was more guitar players than there were good jobs. More bass players too.
Did you have what it took?
Yeah, so I passed that audition, and so I was in the band for all of two months or however long, and they promised that they'd give me £25 a week, which they never did, and all of those things. And so it was more than a couple of months, I think, but it was a lot of just more sawdust on the floor gigs, you know. And we did a few colleges, and I realized something then, though, that you didn't have to I always thought that had a sort of a kid's idea of bands. You know, I always grew up thinking it had to be, you had to get along well and everything. And then I noticed that it wasn't exactly, you know, wine and roses with them. So it was subtle, you know, it was what I always wanted to do. And there I was. And actually, very shortly after I joined up with them, we went to Rockfield. And I saw...
What, so is that your first studio?
I went into Rockfield. That's and awesome. Then recorded a little bit in there. And that was my first experience of
Does
it.
That come
and
out?
Actually, I don't know. I don't know. But I do remember meeting Dave Edmonds because he was recording something in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, he was totally associated with that place, wasn't he, back then? He was,
yeah, and it was... Just to remember just these big cheap JBL speakers all going flat out and it was ear splitting and it was loud and Dave wanted them flat out. He wanted, if you turned them down from 10 to 9, he'd notice there'd be something wrong.
It seems totally against your style.
That was Dave wasn't producing it. It was, I don't know, what was happening. I think the band were producing that.
When did you find you were a singer?
I still don't regard myself as a singer at all. It took me a long time to think of myself as a guitar player, never mind that. And then as a songwriter, that took a while. And singer just never even counted. I just...
Well, you say that, but I don't know if you've noticed, but you've actually sung about 25 albums.
Yeah, I know, but you know how it happens. I'm sure you understand and how it happens, and I still don't.
I mean, when you say you don't see yourself, it's like, do you wish someone else had done it, or you know, was it kind of like, well,
you were the only man.
Well, yes, I was the only one to. Yeah, I think I was the only one to do it, and once I found that people didn't walk out, you know, that people stayed. And then you'd play a club and then the next time you played, there'd be a queue down the stairs and down the corner, you know, that you were starting to pull people in. And the word of mouth, I think, is a genuine thing.
But I know your style had a sort of a speaking quality to it, which, and I know that's one of your
stories,
heroes in the past was Blind Willie McTell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a style that he... used quite often.
I think talking blues, I think that's possibly part of it.
Dylan, I suppose.
Dylan,
I guess so. But that was part of the tradition in American music anyway. And I don't know. It's just a ragbag of stuff. I certainly didn't consider myself much of a singer, but I think Bob Dylan was inspiring in the sense that you realize you didn't have to be a classical, you know, now much as I love and adore Frank Sinatra and all of that stuff, you know, the singer-singers, what I call singer-singers, that I realized that from folk music there was something else happening and that, you know, you could be rough, really pretty, you could be rough as a singer and still tell your story. Your story could still come across. And as long as you meant what you were doing, and people could kind of detect. I think people can detect something.
Insincerity.
I don't think they can. I don't think they say, oh, that's insincere. But something in them registers.
I think there's also a thing with you. There's a model for what you do, which is, I said the person before most similar, is actually Hendrix. Because it's that thing of singing, telling the story, but then actually breaking because my guitar's got to talk.
You have to, exactly. Yeah. You know, I listened a lot to Hendrix and I would be playing when I was playing with a pick, you know, and I'd be playing like trying to play Red House and trying to play, you know, and trying to play Hey Joe, all those things. I listened to hard and I loved Jimi Hendrix. And so it all plays its part, and I think you're right. It's well observed, you know, that I think that's right, because when you're playing, you've got to break off to play. Mm-hmm. And the phrasing of being a of the blues is was like that too, because a pal of mine had a record called Live at the Regal by B.B. King, and the blues fans will know it. And I was struck by that record so much because there were three characters. There was B.B., his voice, there was the audience, and there was his guitar. And there was just like three corners, you know, he'd go... He'd be telling the story. I gave you seven children, and now you say, wow, the audience goes up, and then he plays.
It's gospel, really.
And yeah, yeah. And but the whole thing was just bouncing from one corner of the story to the next corner of the story.
This is really interesting, because I don't, you know, your touring schedules and how many gigs you did and these famous long tours, I mean, it's above and beyond. Probably only Guns N' Roses come close for that kind of touring. But it's because, from what you're saying here, it's because you see the audience as being as important, that the song doesn't really live until it's in front of an audience.
It's quantum. It's observed.
Yeah. It becomes something. I think you're conscious of them. If you're going to play a song like Brothers in Arms or something, when that song is setting up, it's a real tangible thing in the hall, you know. So you can't play it badly. There's something about it that you better play this for real. And then you're kind of conscious that's why they're there. That's why they've come. You know,
inspiring you as well.
They've come to hear you play it well. And
the thing is, the notes you chose that day in the studio when you recorded it become the Holy Grail, don't they? You can't go away from
it. Yeah, that's well spotted. You know, that I started playing, say, Brothers, but other songs can be like that. In the studio, I played it, do-do-do-do, tweedy-dee, right? I don't know why I did that, you know, but that became the furniture of the thing. And I've tried to play it differently. That first phrase. And I was getting nowhere at all. Nothing came close to it. So either I'd got lucky on the thing itself, or I can't explain it. But nothing else worked.
I guess the audience weren't prepared to take anything else. They wanted that.
They wanted that, and once I'd gotten the thing moving, once it started moving down the track, then I could improvise a little bit and move away from what was on the record, and it would become different anyway. Touring something for that long, you would become different, but that's very interesting. That why, in a way, you're just kind of telling them that the song has started, maybe.
Yeah, because I think what's interesting about Dire Straits and the success that you had in the 80s is it goes against everything else we think about that period in a way. You know, we're suddenly there are shorter songs and it's all about hit singles and you know, pop songs and glamour. And here's a band that has rudely ignored punk and sailed through from the early 70s, if you like, and into the 80s, and are making songs 14 minutes long that are giving singles to the radio that are 6 minutes long.
Well, I would have...
Don't care. You don't care.
I would have been part of the punk thing and the new wave thing if I'd been 10 years younger. But I was 28 when the thing happened, you know, when the thing... I'd been around, kicking around the world for a long time, and so I that made me very different.
And became the place to go, didn't you?
If I'd been 18, I wouldn't have survived.
But how did it feel? Because when you started, that whole circuit, that pub circuit and everything in London, that's what was going on. You know, you took like someone like Stuart Copeland, for instance, you talked to him, and you know, he was in Curved Air, and he was that bit older, but his thing was like, well, punk was the only game in town. So that's what we did.
Yeah, but I got on great with Stuart, you know, but we actually did a bunch of gigs together for a while. I don't know, can't remember why, but they were all booked at the same time. And I do remember this, that nobody cared who played first or last. Mm-hmm. It was never an issue. And I certainly don't remember being worried about it. I think it would be whoever got there first would set up and play first. But that was, we were always like that. And
I just think people wanted your music was the place to go for things that were, you could spend time with them, with the pieces, that there was depth and there was intricacy and there was a cinema for the ears, you know, in a lot of the arrangements.
Maybe I'm not sure how it all worked out, but I think I was very lucky, you know, because our record company made CDs. Philips made CD players, and what happened with Brothers is that it coincided with their the CD coincided with that record, and Phonogram, or I think that's what they were called then, Phonogram or Philips, decided to use our record as an illustration of the new technology. So that meant that all these electrical shops got added to, so they were selling the record as well because they were demonstrating the CD player with it. And
you recorded it digitally as well.
Yeah, and we also got lucky with American charts because we had, I think we had So Far Away, we had Walk of Life, and we had Money for Nothing. And sort of like three singles that were hits in America. And
that video was one of the ultimate. It was the first video shown on British MTV, wasn't it?
Right, and the video. So it was just one of those things. It had been growing through making movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it was like this critical mass thing where people wanted to see it live and they wanted to have the records too. So it was just, I think it was luck. It was a convergence of eventualities like that. Like the CD came out and that didn't hurt. But I tell you, the thing that really didn't hurt was having hit singles in America. That I think that was probably the biggest thing
also,
of all.
You got Sting on the, you know, that's.
Yeah.
MTV, one of the greatest guitarists.
Can I just say, actually, a little playing note here, which is that, because that's actually, Money for Nothing is the rockiest, most distorted sound you've ever, ever had. And it's one of the folkiest parts you've ever played, though, isn't it? The finger picking.
It's almost like a little country stump, isn't it?
Because it's actually, apparently, that's, sorry, little music, because that's apparently the key to Smoke on the Water, is that you only play two notes and you finger pick it.
But also you did the Mick Ronson of using the Les Paul with the wah-wah choked back.
Yeah, and it was because I was trying to do one for who did the spoof records. I was trying to do a version for
what, Baron Knight?
No, the American guy, and he does all the spoof.
Oh, Weird Al Yankovic.
Weird Al, and I was trying to do one for Weird Al, and I said, what? How did I used to do that? And then eventually I said, oh, it was the wah-wah pedal. It was stuck in one. And I was literally trying to remember. I'd forgotten. And that's why it didn't happen. And then once I remembered that we had the wah in one place, and now everybody says, yeah, well, of course.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, I couldn't remember. Seriously couldn't remember.
How was it saying goodbye to those guitars?
Oh, that wasn't too hard. I mean, really? It's not those guitars. I mean, it was one of those guitars. Two of them, or maybe a few of them. But it wasn't as bad as all that. And I've got some beautiful guitars. You know, I've got it, and I've still got my 58 Les Paul. And
all right, because what did you record Money for Nothing on, the 58 or the 80?
No, there was the 83. Was that? Well, that's the one I sold actually, but
it just went for $500,000, didn't it?
I don't know. I wasn't there. Didn't
Sorry
want
to
look.
You.
I didn't want to look.
They all went for about $500,000.
I didn't want to look, but.
Actually,
some of it went to charity. The full charity thing I've just done was the teenage cancer thing.
Oh my God, we haven't mentioned that. We need to talk about that before we end, which is quite possibly the greatest collection of guitarists ever seen on a record.
It's for going home.
For going home.
Who's how did it happen? Who's in? They weren't all in the same room, right?
No.
Or did they didn't. They no. all did it from their home studios.
But I'll tell you what.
Well, Pete was first, wasn't he?
Pete Townsend was first. Which is very, which is appropriate because of, you know, the input to the charity itself over the years. So
also, I remember years and years ago, I think it was in Kew or something, you did one of your favourite guitar records things ever, and you said how you thought Won't Get Fooled Again was the sort of greatest expression of joyous guitar playing.
Yeah.
Which I absolutely agree with.
And I love Pete's playing, and I've always been a huge Who fan. And whenever I see, you know, Glyn Johns, I'm always busy reminding him of him hunting amongst the, you know, the speakers with his microphone to get out the sound, you know. Glyn's wonderful. How did
that come together? And did you make all the phone calls yourself?
No. I mean, it was, and in fact, Guy Fletcher did much more than I did in the end because he had to, you know, Guy's a trained recording engineer and has spent his time, you know, sleeping under a warm console if he had to spend the night in the studio.
Old school,
yeah. So Guy knows how it all works. It's very moving piece of playing by Jeff.
That's his last piece of recording, isn't
it? Yeah, I think it may very well be, yeah. And
because Jeff stole from you in the end, didn't he? Did he never used to be a finger player, did he? And
he didn't. Style. Of course he didn't. No, he didn't need to do that. he was on another level altogether, and a wonderful, wonderful player, and just otherworldly guitar player. But it happened very quickly because Pete came in, and nobody plays chords like Pete. And he came into the studio, and he was first in, and of course that gave us a whole dimension to think about straight away. And then Eric, I think, was very soon after, and then David Gilmour, and then shortly after that, actually Hank sent his contribution probably from Australia, right?
Perth.
And tremendous. I mean, because he's played the song for so many years, of course, but what a guitar player. The thing I wanted to explain about Hank's playing was that you use the tremolo arm with your right hand, you play the note with a pick, and you use the tremolo arm to occasionally just to let the notes sing out. But that means that you don't then mess it about with left hand vibrato. You've got to keep that. And I think Hank can play any way he wants. I think he can do that, or he can play with his fingers, or he can. Mm-hmm. I think he can do it all. But that to get that style, a Wonderful Land thing that captivated me when I was a kid, that's the way you play. It was like a Duane Eddy style of playing, you know. And you've got to be in love with. Actually, we had Duane Eddy's on it. I remember when I heard Because They're Young for the first time, I learned there was a little kid up our street that had it. And I went round to his house and made him play it 10 times. You know, you just got to be such a little, I mean, who's the little maniac down the streets made me play this record 10 times?
Yeah.
That was me. Sorry, Michael.
Brian did this, a similar thing, didn't he? With someone he heard, how someone had an Elvis record and he made this woman, Little Richard, and he made her play it again.
Oh,
at
yeah.
At her house. And he ended up sort of dancing with her. She was up in the window and he was out in the street.
Well, this is
clearly a Newcastle thing.
But I think this is what we had that, you know, is missing now for younger people. And that's, we had to mine. This was for all of the nuggets that you could find.
Absolutely.
Because it wasn't on streaming.
And blues, the blues, when that came along, we had to go hunting for it exactly.
But it was like the gold rush in the end.
There's a thing you'd hear about a record, and it would be months before you got to hear it.
That's
You'd be anticipating hearing this record.
And I think that's what a lot of kids now like about vinyl. Because they've got the record in their hand, they can read the liner notes and everything. And there's something about holding the cover. It's got something, hasn't it?
Well, it's also the thing of I don't want to get into this sort of old people, but the fact that liner notes don't exist at all in streaming. And I don't know why They thought,
actually,
you don't
in
need
fairness,
them.
I noticed that Apple have started to do it now. If you click on the three little dots by the side of a track,
okay,
you get got, some.
Right, yeah.
Are you taking this new album out on the road?
No.
Why is that?
Well, because I'm never. I want to spend more time at home.
Right.
And it's just instead of being cruel to the people around, you know, I want to. It's probably actually they're probably all wondering, you know. But I think they're probably all going to say, get out there, you know, enough of you hanging around. But I want to be able to. It's really so that I can write, and so that I can write a song, because a lot of these songs have been written. Partly when I'm on the road and it's 2 a.m. with a, you know, second glass of wine, third glass of wine, and I've got a gig to, you know, coming up, maybe got a gig coming up next day. And you'd be familiar with it. So just, it's not the ideal way to live. It's not the ideal way to write, you know, music. And I think music, songs, and, I just like to be able to write the songs at home or see how they come out and
to keep making music,
go into
new
my
music.
Yeah, and go into my studio to get
I was
a chance.
Say, yeah, if you, I mean, I think we'd all like to go to your studio.
Yeah, it's a lovely.
And do and
I
do.
Have, it's such a great studio to work in, and because it was built with the whole idea, you know, that it would have it would. I'd be able to do the things that I haven't been able to do in other studios. Mm. You know, you'd go into another studio somewhere and you can't do this because you can't do this because...
Okay, that's really good enough. Also, because it's so well thought out. I remember I've worked there a lot, and I was there a while ago working on a film, and a friend of mine, Steve McLaughlin, who's this great film producer and engineer, and he said, this is the best studio in the world. I said, yeah, I think it is. He went, no, it's the best studio in the world because of this. And he just pressed this button on the desk, and there's a button that closes the big heavy door between the studio and the control room.
It's the only. It's the only.
That is it, because musicians, half your time is wasted getting the tape op to go and close the door because musicians have left it open. Yeah. So literally that button is what makes it the best.
That's the only button in the studio I know how to work.
Mark, thanks for coming in. Yeah. And good luck with the new album.
Thank you so much.
This has been an absolute delight.
Total pleasure.
Rock Hunters is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.